It's March, and wouldn't you know it, the hottest team in the ACC is Virginia. Meanwhile, a young Hokies team takes the floor on day one at the conference tournament. And was the league's best player not even on the ballot for Player of the Year? We'll talk about that and much, much more this week on Teal and Barber. Welcome in to Episode 3 of Teal and Barber, the Richmond Times-Dispatch and Richmond.com's Virginia Tech, UVA, and ACC sports podcast. We're coming to you a few days early this week so we can preview the ACC tournament. But before we take our show kind of on the road to Jim Boeheim's favorite city of Greensboro, North Carolina, we wanted to get a show in here beforehand. I'm Mike Barber. I'm the ACC beat writer for the paper. And I'm happy, as always, to be joined by my co-host, 13-time Sports Writer of the Year and Virginia Sports Hall of Famer, David Teal. David, hello.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I am excellent. I am recovering from a taco tour of Charlottesville that I did over the weekend. I tried five different taco restaurants, and it made me think, I know that Cabo Fish Taco in Blacksburg is your go-to spot at Tech games. Do you have a go-to, a favorite restaurant in Charlottesville?
Not really. I mean, I've often, because of its convenience to the sports complex, I'm a foods of all nations guy, just for carry out and prepared foods. I love that place. I often bring home some pumpkin bread for my daughter because she loves that, and highly recommend the curried chicken salad or the shrimp and asparagus combination at Foods of All Nations.
Excellent calls. And I'll add to that that if you're looking for a really good chorizo, they have an excellent chorizo there. Very spicy, though, so make sure your palate can handle it. But that is not the main topic we wanted to hit. We have a loaded show here this week with so much going on. And before we get into looking ahead to the conference tournament, David, I wanted to ask you about the All-ACC team, Player of the Year. Some of those awards came out this morning. I wanted to get your thoughts on some of how you voted, but also some snubs and maybe some oddities. And I want to start right at the, you know, we're heading to a presidential election, so we'll say right at the top of the ballot, yeah. The Player of the Year. And, you know, the Player of the Year was Duke's Trey Jones, who's had an excellent year, a tremendous defensive player. But I think there's a growing sense, and you see it on Twitter, social media, that the best player in the league wasn't on the ballot. Explain that.
Well, Mike, in my mind, he wasn't. And it's an online ballot. And when you accessed it, as I did late Saturday night, early Sunday morning after getting home from Virginia Louisville, imagine my surprise when I went to vote for Vernon Carey as Player of the Year, and he was not an option among the nominations. Duke nominated Trey Jones. Duke could have nominated both Carey and Jones. Any program can nominate as many players as it wants, but perhaps suspecting that Carey and Jones might split votes, Duke went with the older player, which is not a surprise, the sophomore in Trey Jones, limiting our options as voters. If I were running the show, we wouldn't be limited to school nominations. We could vote for whomever we please, but that's not how the voting process works.
Yeah. Now, to be clear, Trey Jones had a great year. Okay, 16.2 points a game. He was the floor general for that team. He is a tremendous on-ball defender. In many ways, he was the engine who made them go. But I agree with you. Vernon Carey, to me, 17.8 points per game. Just a low post presence with what he could do. He averaged 8.8 rebounds. He was the guy that when you went to play Duke or you went to watch Duke, you thought, he's got a chance to just take this game over. A little bit odd that the guy that it seems like most people went to vote for last night wasn't on the ballot. Anything else stand out to you in terms of guys who were first team or not, guys who were all rookie or not?
Well, I think the most striking thing, Mike, is the top two seeds in the ACC tournament are Florida State and UVA, and neither has a player on first team. That's the first time that's ever happened, that the top two seeds in the conference tournament are not represented on the all-league first team. In fact, Florida State is only the second outright champion, joining North Carolina in 2011 as not having a first-team representative. Previously, all outright champions have had at least one player on the first team. So that was the most striking thing to me. I didn't see any egregious snubs. I had Kihei Clark on second team rather than Markell Johnson. Instead, Johnson made second and Clark made third. I had Trent Forrest first team from Florida State instead of Elijah Hughes of Syracuse. But otherwise, you know, I thought it went pretty much according. I had Kihei Clark on the all defensive team instead of Georgia Tech's James Banks.
Yeah, and Banks is an excellent defender, but that was the one that jumped out to me. Kihei Clark as kind of the spearhead of the nation's top defense, his ability to play on ball and going back to what we said about Vernon Carey, UVA nominated, I believe, Kihei Clark to be the defensive player of the year. He received three votes for defensive player of the year, but Mamadi Diakite makes the all defensive team where you're not limited and you can vote for any of the players. Am I understanding that one correctly?
Well, Virginia nominated Clark and Diakite for the all defensive team. So both options were open to voters. But Diakite was not nominated for Defensive Player of the Year, so you could not have voted for him if you had chosen.
So again, a little maybe politicking, trying to not split the vote there between Diakite and Clark. And then the only other one on the teams that jumped out to me, and maybe this is a case of, you know, we're closer, so we have a deeper appreciation, but Landers Nolley is the top scoring freshman at Virginia Tech. Early on, he was the guy who was making it go. He's been in a terrible slump the last seven games. He's hit, you know, 14% of his three-pointers the last seven games, so just really having trouble putting the ball in the basket. Tyrese Radford, on the other hand, has been kind of the do-it-all guy at Tech, and he's been, in some ways, the go-to guy. If they needed a big bucket, they go to him. A little surprised, at least I was a little surprised, that it was Nolley on the all-rookie team instead of Radford.
I really wasn't that surprised. I did not vote for Nolley. I did vote for Radford. But, you know, a lot of times people are just going to go on stats and they're not going to parse it game by game. They're not going to look at trends. And I get that. Yeah, I think you make a very good point that you and I, being based here in the Commonwealth, are a lot closer and follow the Hokies more closely than others might. Radford even got some love for Rookie of the Year. I mean, he got a couple votes instead of Vernon Carey, which struck me as borderline preposterous.
Yeah, no one should have gotten a vote for Rookie of the Year other than Vernon Carey Jr. And again, I thought he was the Player of the Year as well, but we've already covered that topic. Now moving on, all of these players we're talking about are headed to Greensboro for the conference tournament. Florida State is the number one seed. It's going to be, I think, an interesting year in Greensboro. I think the top seeds are going to need to win. I think they're fighting for NCAA tournament seeding, as opposed to some years where Virginia or Duke or Carolina has gone into the league tournament knowing they're a number one seed in the tournament and not really having that work to do. So let me start there and ask you, who is the team or who are the teams who can make the most significant impact on their NCAA seeds this week, and what do they have to do?
Well, NCAA seeds, I think all of the four perceived locks, and they are locks, Duke, Louisville, Florida State, and Virginia, could all enhance their seedings quite significantly because they're going to have chances to play one another and get those so-called quadrant one victories. But the team with the most at stake in terms of its postseason is North Carolina State, because the Wolfpack is on that proverbial bubble, or so it seems to most of us who try to track these things. And Kevin Keats's club needs to do some damage in Greensboro.
Now, I think, and I think you agree with me, I don't think there's any question that NC State is NCAA tournament caliber, but we've seen that before. NCAA tournament caliber doesn't mean you get in. You have to get it done on the floor. What do they need to do? What has to happen in Greensboro in terms of how far do they have to go? How many games do they have to win before you're going to say, okay, they join the other four as locks?
As locks, well, the first game that the Pack will play is Wednesday afternoon against either Wake Forest or Pittsburgh. I don't think it does them a bit of good, maybe just because of the caliber of opponent. But then would come a Thursday afternoon quarterfinal against Duke. If NC State beats Duke for a second time this season, then I think the Wolfpack will have a much more relaxed selection Sunday.
So, I mean, if it comes down to beating Duke, that's not a very good position to be in, to have to beat Duke, to have to beat them in Greensboro, which I don't know if you guys have maps or globes in front of you, but the crowd will be partial there, I think it's fair to say, to the Blue Devils. I've seen some NCAA tournaments there that certainly were that way. If they win that first game, which, again, admittedly, you're correct that it's not against a marquee opponent. If they win that game and are competitive against Duke, is this just a case of kind of wait it out and see what happens on the bubble?
Yeah, I think then you're rooting for certain teams around the country to lose or win. And it's just a matter of what happens in other conferences. And are there the so-called bid thieves that come from out of nowhere to steal an automatic dropping a lock into the at-large pool?
Next up, I wanted to ask, and this is a sort of a general question at the tournament and, you know, NC State or for anybody, but really Virginia is who I'm looking at here with consecutive wins, the win streak they're on going into Greensboro. Does momentum, in your experience, does momentum matter in conference tournaments? Are teams that are rolling at the end of the year, do they tend to do well, or is it kind of a non-factor?
I don't think it's much of a factor, really. And I don't know, Mike, that there's much of a carryover from the conference tournament to the NCAA tournament. Take Virginia. Virginia last season won its final eight regular season games, just like this season, and then lost in the ACC tournament semifinals to Florida State. Well, we all know what happened after that. Cavaliers win six in a row and are cutting down the nets in Minneapolis. And I believe if you go back, it's almost 50-50 for ACC national champions, whether they have won the conference tournament or not. Just as many have lost in the league tournament and gone on to win the national championship as have won it.
So as we look at this Virginia team, we know how well they're playing here down the stretch. That's eight in a row. We've talked on this show about the close games, pulling them out, having that kind of battle-tested vibe going on. As you look at their bracket, their path to an ACC title, if you will, they have the double bye. They're the number two seed. Do we like the potential matchups that we see looming for this team?
Well, Notre Dame or Boston College on Thursday night in the quarters, Virginia will be favored and should win. Now, will the game come down in the final 4 minutes? Of course it will. I mean, we've been there and done that. And then in the semifinals, if Virginia indeed survives BC or Notre Dame, then I think the Cavaliers are looking at playing either Louisville for a third time or North Carolina for a third time. I don't see Syracuse winning two and getting to the semis. So I think on Friday night in Greensboro in the second semifinal, it's going to be Virginia against Louisville or North Carolina.
Yeah, I think that Louisville matchup is tough. You mentioned they split. That first loss to Louisville, we've talked about, that was sort of a turning point. I think it was 80-73 at Louisville. It was the game where Thomas Woldetensai really got going from the outside. The offense kind of found itself. But I'm glad that you mentioned North Carolina, because it would be easy not to. They're the 14 seed. They've got to play day one against Virginia Tech. But they're healthy. They're playing pretty well down the stretch. I know they're the 14 seed, but David, is North Carolina maybe the most dangerous 14 seed you can remember?
Oh, North Carolina is without question, Mike, the most dangerous last place team in the history of this event. There is no question. And they are talented. Garrison Brooks, Cole Anthony, Brandon Robinson, Armando Baycott. Now you can go down the line. And I think winning five in as many days is an awfully big ask. I believe it's been done once, and that was at the Big East tournament back when it had, I forget how many members the Big East had back then, but a team, I don't know if it was Syracuse or UConn, came from way out of nowhere and won five in 5 days. But that's a mighty tall task. In fact, the only team to ever win four games in as many days of the ACC tournament was Duke in Brooklyn a few years ago when the Blue Devils were the 5 seed.
Right. All makes sense. And then I want to ask this last thing about Virginia as we look at them, because we talked about Kihei Clark and his defense and the role he's taken on. We've talked about on this show this year of having the ball in his hands and how many big shots he's hit. We've talked about Mamadi Diakite and what he's provided them, and he's hit a ton of big late shots for this team. I'm curious, in your opinion, who's the most important player for UVA this postseason here in Greensboro, onto the NCAAs? Who's the guy that is going to be maybe the most important or central figure in your mind for the Cavaliers?
Well, if you look away from Clark and Diakite, they will be central, certainly. But to me, it's Jay Huff. And do you get the Jay Huff of the last couple of weeks, or do you get the Jay Huff who blows hot and cold and is irrelevant one night and maybe relevant the next? Once these games, and they will quickly morph into very evenly matched one possession, two possession games, Jay Huff's going to be essential, and Virginia's going to need him to be one of the guys that it can rely on.
And that brings us to who you got.
Okay, we'll make this one simple. It's ACC tournament week. So, David, who you got winning the league title this week in Greensboro?
Duke. We got the Blue Devils as the 4 seed. I think they can get NC State in the quarters and then beat Florida State for the second time this season in the semifinals. And then I think the Blue Devils will beat Louisville in the championship game.
Okay, Mike, who you got winning the league championship this weekend?
David, that's a great pick, but I think you're wrong, because I think that Duke is the best team in the league, but I think Florida State is the team that is best suited to win this tournament. I mean, with their depth, with the number of bodies they can throw at you, with the way they defend, with the fact that you have to play day after day after day in Greensboro, even with the byes, I think that this Florida State team is built to win this kind of a tournament. I don't think they're going to be the most successful come the NCAA, come the big dance, but I think Florida State gets it done in Greensboro. That brings us to the fact that, David, you wrote a story this week and about, shall we say politely, the advancing age of some of the ACC's most revered coaches, some of the biggest names in the game, Roy Williams, Mike Krzyzewski, Jim Boeheim. These guys have been doing it forever. They've been doing it at such a high level forever. And when I say high level, I mean national titles. These are icons of the game of college basketball and the game in basketball in general. What does it say about this group that they're all still active and still getting it done at this point?
Mike, it struck me once I started researching this, because I wasn't sure of the answer. But I knew that Jim Boeheim, who is 75, Mike Krzyzewski, 73, Leonard Hamilton, 71. By the way, the youngest 71-year-old man I have ever laid eyes on. Jim Larrañaga, 70, and Roy Williams, 69. So that's remarkable in and of itself. But then I got to wondering, are these the five oldest coaches in the history of ACC men's basketball? And sure enough, they are. And they're all active simultaneously. And by the way, they're the oldest, and it's not even close. The only guys who coached beyond 65 were Dean Smith at North Carolina and Gary Williams at Maryland, both retired at 66. And here you have these guys way north of that. And as you mentioned, they continue to do it at a high level. And yes, we mentioned North Carolina sharing last place this season with Wake Forest and Pittsburgh. But let's be clear, you better get the Tar Heels this season, because that recruiting class next season is loaded, and you can't imagine that Carolina is going to have the spate of injuries next season that it had this. So Carolina is going to be right back in the top three or four next season. So, I mean, I asked each of these guys about potential retirement, and of course they were like, no way, not thinking about it, not in the plans. Certainly in their private moments, it has to cross their minds, but they are going strong. And by the way, Mike, Jim Boeheim, he is the oldest coach in Division I men's basketball history at 75.
And he nearly had his team on the bubble this year again. So to our point of doing it well, they certainly are. I also thought they handled, because some of those questions you asked them on the ACC teleconference, we all had a chance to hear the interactions. I thought they handled being asked about their age pretty well, didn't you, David?
Yeah, I really did. My favorite exchange, well, I had two favorite exchanges. One was with Leonard Hamilton when I asked him first about his quote-unquote advanced age, but then I asked him, Coach, does the R word ever cross your mind? And he immediately said, what's the R word? And when I said retirement, he just laughed and laughed and said, as long as I can see the jersey names and numbers on the backs of the uniforms, I'm in. And then Jim Larrañaga, when I asked him about it, he responded with a question of his own and said, did you see my dance moves in the locker room after our Virginia Tech triple overtime win? And just in case I hadn't, he then texted me the Instagram link to said dance moves, which I just thought was fabulous.
And if you have not seen that Instagram post, go find it, because it is Jim Larrañaga at his finest. The right word there, David.
I let's put it this way: I don't know if I've seen Jim Larrañaga that jazz since George Mason made the Final Four in 2006.
Dancing for dancing. Now, in your time covering these guys, so much in the game has changed. Who's changed or adapted their style, kind of their approach, the most among that group?
I think it's Krzyzewski. I really do. Just because he has, much like John Calipari at Kentucky, and much to some fans' chagrin, he has embraced the one and done. He believes that Duke can, and obviously can, and should recruit the best prospects in the country. And so he does, without regard to whether they are projected as a lottery pick after one college season. And he's won two national championships that way in 2010 and 2015. And yes, the Blue Devils are only the number four seed in this tournament, but they went 15-5 in this league, and they beat Kansas, and they beat Michigan State. Would anybody be shocked if Duke won a sixth national championship this season? I wouldn't be shocked. I don't anticipate picking Duke when the bracket comes out. But, you know, he still has his program on the elite level. And when the NBA and its Players Association gets together and the one and done goes away, if Mike Krzyzewski is still the coach at Duke, and I believe he will be, he'll change again. He'll figure it out.
You mentioned it, and you mentioned in your article, which I encourage people to get over to richmond.com. It should be posting this afternoon as we record this on Monday. Your story on these elder statesman coaches of the ACC. Who are you most surprised to see still in it? Because you mentioned in the article that Jim Boeheim got as far as to have a coach in waiting in Mike Hopkins. So it looked like the end was there for Jim. And then he kind of changed his mind a little bit and said, you know what, I'm going to keep going for a little while. And Mike Hopkins said, I'm going across the country. I'm going to take a head job and do my thing. Who are you most surprised is still the boss on the sideline right now?
Yeah, he's the one, Mike. He seemed to be on his way out. And let's not forget there was an NCAA issue up there where he was suspended and victories were stripped and, you know, all the requisite NCAA punishments / sanctions. But yet he has soldiered on. And as you referenced, Mike Hopkins went off to the University of Washington, his former assistant and head coach in waiting. And I asked him this, and he said it has no effect. But I still wonder. His son's on his team. And Buddy Boeheim's a sophomore. He's got two more years left. And I just wonder if in his heart of hearts, Jim Boeheim wants to see it through coaching his son for two more seasons.
Well, maybe some of these guys are going to hang on and coach their grandkids, which
brings us. Krzyzewski already does.
That's
right. His grandson is a walk-on at Duke. He's redshirting this season. So if Mike wants to see it all the way through with his grandson, he's got to coach four more seasons.
And that brings us to take it or leave it.
Okay, take it or leave it. When we tip off next season, will all five of these guys still be coaching? David?
I certainly think so, Dean and Mike. I'm going to take them at their word that they are not plotting exit strategies, that they all feel energized, and that they all intend to be back.
Mike, will they still be coaching next season?
I think David's right, and I thought that Roy was the one that maybe was getting close to saying enough is enough, but because of how bad this year was, I'm going to take it, the idea of them all being back, because he's not going out the way this year went. He's not going out with the team that's coming back. I think all these guys, you got to give them respect. Yeah, they're getting older. Yeah, they're up there in years, but they keep winning, and they keep winning with some passion, so I'm going to take it. I think they're all back. Before we get out of here today, I had the chance to cover Liberty's A-Sun title win over Lipscomb on Sunday. Richie McKay, the former Virginia assistant, he's got his team really playing the UVA style. I have a story up on Richmond.com right now talking about the fact that, you know, Richie has basically built himself a mini UVA there at Liberty. Virginia leads the nation in scoring defense, and Liberty is number two. He's got the Flames back in the NCAA tournament for a second straight year. But they're not alone in the state. When you're thinking about teams outside of the ACC, we see Richmond, and Chris Mooney has the Spiders sitting on that NCAA bubble. William & Mary had a disappointing end there to its CAA run. They had a big year. So, David, outside of the ACC, who's the best basketball team in Virginia?
I think it would be Richmond, Mike. Just the way the Spiders are playing since Blake Francis, their leading scorer, came back from, I believe he missed six games with the fractured sternum, two of which Richmond lost. But the Spiders closed the regular season on a 9-1 run. They are the number two seed in this week's Atlantic 10 tournament up at Barclays Center behind Dayton, which, by the way, is, I think, tracking for a number one regional seed in the NCAA tournament. And, you know, Richmond, if it gets in the NCAA tournament, I have a hunch the Spiders are going to get there. That non-conference win over Wisconsin back in November at Barclays Center, by the way, is going to loom large, because Wisconsin has very quietly, the Badgers are the number one seed in the Big Ten tournament. So that's a heck of a non-league victory for Chris Mooney in Richmond.
Yeah, and that's a team in Richmond that's, they're 24-7. They won 9 of their last 10. And then you think about, okay, I think they've earned it. I think you're right. I think they're in the field. I think they've earned their way there. Can they do anything when they get there? And the number that jumps out at me, David, they're 9-3 away from home this year. Only good teams win on the road, right? I mean, everybody can pull one, but to be 9-3 away from home, that maybe is Chris Mooney's biggest accomplishment this season. And I mean, I think they're a team that if they get the chance, I don't think you want to play them in the first round of the NCAA tournament.
Mike, you make a really good point. And I spent an hour last week with Atlantic 10 Commissioner Bernadette McGlade, who was on the NCAA selection committee. And now she must recuse herself whenever the panel is discussing a team from her league. But she made it clear, as have other committee members over the years in various interviews, that how you perform away from your home court is essential when the committee is evaluating your at-large credentials, when the committee is evaluating your potential seed in the bracket. And oh, by the way, Richmond's non-conference strength of schedule will also serve it very well. Number 85 in the country, which means the Spiders scheduled very ambitiously, and the committee will notice that.
Yeah, and that's another article that if you get a chance to get to richmond.com, if you want to get a better handle on how the selection process works, David's story with Bernadette McGlade, that's up on right now on richmond.com as well. I told you it was a busy show, David. We packed a lot in this week.
We did, and we've got a lot ahead of us for the rest of the week. Mike, it's my favorite week of the year. We talked about older coaches. I'm an older scribe, and I don't ever lose sight of the fact of how lucky I am. And this will be my 37th consecutive ACC tournament. And it is my favorite event of the season, and I am very eager to get to Greensboro tomorrow afternoon and be on press row for Virginia Tech, North Carolina tomorrow night.
And like we said about those coaches who are still doing it at the highest level, I like to say that you, sir, are still doing it at the highest level. It's a pleasure to do the show with you.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. My fingers try.
That's our show for this week. Thanks for listening. You can get all our coverage of UVA, Tech, and this upcoming ACC tournament by subscribing to richmond.com. Our Sports Plus option gives you access to all of it for $6.99 a month, or sign up for a full year of Sports Plus for less than $60. It's the best way to follow your team this March and a great way to support local journalism. Today's show was produced by Dean Hoffmeyer. Teal and Barber is a podcast of the Richmond Times-Dispatch and Richmond.com. For David Teal, I'm Mike Barber. See you in Greensboro. Thanks for listening, and please join us again.